Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We return to what is happening to migrant asylum seekers. The latest threat to the Flores Agreement, which was established to protect migrant children, and the Donald is threatening to send undocumented immigrants to sanctuary cities. Our guest is Peter Shea, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. Also, the Sojourner Truth Africa Watch. We discuss the 30-year leader of the Sudan was deposed by the military following a general uprising in the country, with protesters demanding an end to austerity measures and for President Bashar to step down. A military government is in place, and although they have promised to establish civilian rule, Sudan's overwhelmingly young population, as well as 70% of the women in Sudan, have their doubts and are remaining on the streets. Meanwhile, Bashar is wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity for atrocities overseen by his government in Darfur. And meanwhile, what some are calling an Arab Spring has spread to Algeria, where the longtime president has been forced to step down. What's at stake? Also, the U.S.-backed government in Tripoli, Libya, put in place after the U.S.-backed overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, is under threat, with serious fighting threatening the capital city. What's going on? Our guest is Dr. Gerald Horn. Also, the growing alliance between left-leaning organizations and tendencies in the United States and Europe. Our guest is Alan Minsky, Executive Director of the Progressive Democrats of America. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandiri. French officials are turning their attention to rebuilding Notre Dame. Firefighters spent more than 12 hours battling to extinguish the inferno which destroyed the spire and roof, but spared its bell towers and the purported crown of Christ. French President Emmanuel Macron said Notre Dame belongs to all French people and is important even to those who have never visited it.
I also want to spare a thought for all our compatriots, because the Notre Dame of Paris is our history, our literature, our imagination, the place where we have lived all our great moments, our epidemics, our wars, our liberation.
Officials consider the fire an accident, possibly as a result of the restoration work at the World Architectural Treasure. 13 million tourists a year visit Notre Dame. The Democratic leaders of three House committees are calling on Trump administration officials to release documents related to their deliberations on sending undocumented immigrants to sanctuary cities. In a three-page letter, the Democrats call the plan a bizarre and unlawful attempt to score political points. They say the administration lacks the legal authority to transfer undocumented migrants to sanctuary jurisdictions. The letter was sent by Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler, Oversight Committee Chair Elijah Cummings, Homeland Security Committee Chair Benny Thompson. Trump continued to rail about the situation at the border during an appearance in Minnesota. He made the case the issue could be a winning one for Republicans in 2020 and said immigrant asylum claims can't be believed.
It's a big con job, that's what it is. And in Congress... And Congress has to get smart. And honestly, when I say Congress, I can't blame the Republicans. The Republicans want to do it, but you need the votes of the Democrats. You need 60 votes in the Senate, and we're a little bit short in the House. We can retake the House. I think over this issue, I think we can retake. Look, as soon as we do, we're going to get this straightened out.
Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee is the latest sanctuary city official to denounce President Trump. She said it's unacceptable the president is using immigrants and those seeking asylum as pawns in yet another one of his twisted political games. The Congressional Black Caucus and other progressive groups are speaking out in support of Minnesota Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. They're denouncing President Trump for retweeting a video which has led to a surge of death threats against her. The video intersperses images of Omar and the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and made it seem as if she were flippant with regards to the attack. Los Angeles Congresswoman Karen Bass chairs the Congressional Black Caucus.
To see the president, who should be serving as a bridge to bring people together, has once again shown his divisiveness, but really putting her in danger.
More than 200 progressive leaders signed on to a letter saying they stand in solidarity with Omar and against the rise of Islamophobia and attempts to divide the country. The letter was circulated by American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, Color of Change Executive Director Rashad Robinson, and Democracy for America Chief Executive Yvette Simpson. It calls Omar a visionary leader demanding an end to the culture of endless wars and calling out white supremacists and war criminals in the Trump administration. The letter says those positions and her identity as the first black Muslim congresswoman have made her the target of racist and bigoted attacks from Trump, right-wing media, and extremist Republican leaders, and even at times, Democratic colleagues. Sudanese protesters say the ruling military council, which ousted longtime President Omar al-Bashir last week, must step aside in favor of civilian rule. The military council held talks with opposition leaders over the weekend and released some political prisoners. The military also backed off an attempt to disperse an ongoing protest sit-in outside military headquarters in the capital, Khartoum. A member of the group spearheading the protest, the Sudanese Professional Association, told Al Jazeera they will continue to protest until the military council leaves power and a civilian transitional government takes its place.
We want the government to be handled to a civilian body. We want the military council to be cancelled and a new council to be formed, which is civilian. Major by civilian, with some military representation on it. This is our main demand. Then we want also a transitional government with all its executive rights and to extend the transitional period to 4 years.
The African Union gave Sudan's military 15 days to hand over power to a civilian-led political authority or face suspension from AU activities. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we're going to start out today's show with our Africa Watch occasional series that we are bringing to you. And I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, who's the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books, including his most recently published books, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, and Storming the Heavens, African Americans in the Early Fight for the Right to Fly. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, Dr. Horn, we will have your comments in just a moment, but just giving our listeners a bit of background here. We are going to start off, Dr. Horn, with our Africa Watch. Actually, we'll first discuss the Sudan, and then we will move on to Libya and Algeria, if that is okay with you.
Oh, sure.
And right. So the 30-year leader of the Sudan was deposed by the military. Protesters have stayed on the streets. They're refusing to step down until a civilian government has been established. Part of the background is after years of fighting, the Sudan was balkanized. It was divided in two with the formation of South Sudan and a row between the North, ruled by Bashir, and the newly formed South Sudan broke out over oil-rich fields, which got taken away taken over by the newly formed South. Bashir's Sudan not only faced U.S. sanctions, but also, along with the loss of oil revenue, led to the economic crisis that many are protesting now on the streets. So who are the protesters who have vowed to stay in the streets until a civilian government is formed? What's at stake in the Sudan? What we're going to do is we're going to go to a clip from Al Jazeera about what the protesters are demanding.
Despite a military coup ousting Bashir last Thursday and his successor 24 hours later, the sit-in and protests continue.
We insist on continuing with this revolution until our demands are met. Our demands are known and clear, bringing down the regime completely.
They're angry because they feel their revolution is being stolen by the military council that overthrew Bashir. The council has appointed members from the military to run the country. It's promised an all-party inclusive government for the transitional period, but under the military's supervision. That's something those on the streets refuse to accept.
Protesters have been here in front of the army headquarters in Khartoum for more than 10 days, and they say they're ready to stay for even longer if their demands are not met. They want the dismantling of the Security and Intelligence Agency, as well as accountability for the members of the former regime. But most of all, they want a civilian government in a country that has been ruled by a military leader for more than 30 years.
The military council says it won't use force to disperse the protesters, something activists say they attempted to do on Monday morning. It has issued orders to reform the security agency and the judiciary and says it's arrested officials from the previous government who will be held to account. But it insists protest groups and political parties must agree on the structure of a transitional government.
We need to agree on the basis of forming the government. The ball is now in their court. There was a question on the timeline, but the ball is in the court of political forces and other bodies that I mentioned, from organizations, youth and women. If they're ready today and agree on anything, we are ready to execute.
Yeah, so Dr. Gerald Horn, you know, a lot of people are watching this and not recalling the earlier history of the Sudan, including the conflict in Darfur, the dividing up of the country with the formation of South Sudan, a government that was very much backed in the South by the United States, and sanctions being slapped on Bashir's government. Now, that doesn't excuse Bashir, and likely there's very good reason that the protesters are out on the street. But just remind us a bit about that history, Dr. Horn.
Well, you mentioned the conflict in Darfur, which is a factor in terms of Mr. al-Bashir being charged before the International Criminal Court. One of the issues at play right now is whether or not his military comrades will dispatch him to The Hague. I tend to think not least because the International Criminal Court has lost credibility because, as you know, they had supposedly embarked on investigating U.S. human rights violations in Afghanistan, but seemingly have dropped that initiative, not least because the U.S. authorities refused to give the chief prosecutor of the ICC a visa to enter the United States of America. In any case, you are correct to focus on this history. South Sudan had a good deal of oil wealth and still does, except now it's not under the regime of the Khartoum-based government. Recall that a leader of South Sudan still wears a Texas cowboy hat, an homage to George W. Bush, who was so instrumental in helping to push South Sudan towards independence. In some ways, what's happening in Sudan is one of the last chapters of the Cold War. Recall that when Mr. al-Bashir first came to power in the 1980s, he was in bed with religious zealots who considered themselves to be Muslims, but that was considered to be acceptable to the United States. Recall that Osama bin Laden himself had sought sanctuary in Sudan, and one of the reasons why Washington looked the other way at this kind of alliance was because Sudan had one of the strongest left-wing movements on the African continent, the Sudanese Communist Party, which is now prominent in the demonstrations in Khartoum, was the most significant communist party on the African continent outside of South Africa. But now, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Washington in some ways is willing to sacrifice Mr. al-Bashir, although winking at him for decades. Recall also that the demonstrators are keeping on the streets or remaining on the streets because they fear that what happened in Egypt will befall what happened in Sudan, the southern neighbor of Egypt. Recall that Hosni Mubarak, in the early stages of what was called the Arab Spring, the longtime, long-term dictator in Cairo, was forced out of power. That led to Mohamed Morsi, a Muslim Brotherhood leader, surging to power in Cairo, replaced by General al-Sisi, the current leader of Egypt, who was just welcomed in the Oval Office by the White House, even though he's hatching plans, as we speak, to stay in office to 2030 or perhaps even 2024. There is a fear amongst protesters if they're not careful, that kind of saga will unfold in Sudan.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, it's just interesting that the protesters are getting quite a bit of play in mainstream media in Europe as well as here in the United States. And that might have to do with the, Sudan being important, the oil wealth there, but also the ongoing struggle between North and South. But it's interesting also to see that so many women are out on the street, a huge percentage of the protesters, and they're protesting oppression against women, having to live under Sharia law, etc. But it's just interesting to me that the coverage that's getting, where they're demanding that their president step down, as opposed to an island nation like Haiti, where protesters have been on the street demanding that their president step down. But in the case of Haiti, their president is being backed by the United States, not so in the Sudan. Dr. Horn, any comments on that?
Well, I would make a couple of points. One is that a number of professional organizations are prominent in terms of the protests in Sudan, particularly doctors and lawyers, and both groups have a complement of women in the leadership. You might have seen the iconic photograph that's emerged from the protests in Sudan with a woman with her finger gesticulating, making very pointed remarks, which has gone viral across the internet. Secondly, Mr. al-Bashir was able to remain in power, not least because he had various contending security factions, and he was at the center of this spider web. This began to fall apart, however, just about 10 days ago when various security factions were actually at each other's throats about to fire on one another in unleashing perhaps a violent civil war. And it's at that point that top military leaders stepped in and told Mr. al-Bashir that he had to go. That is to say, he had to relinquish his hold on the top civilian leadership. It's unclear as we speak what is going to happen in Sudan, whether or not an Egyptian-type scenario will unfold, or whether or not the protesters in the streets will stay firm and help to foil the military's plan to stay in power for 2 years to manage what they call a, quote, transition, unquote.
Right. And the woman you referred to is known as Kandaka, or Nubian Queen, that was seen leading a chant. And also the Sudanese Professionals Association, or SPA, is described as a collaboration of doctors, health workers, and lawyers who are said to be leading the demonstrations. But, you know, unless you're really there on the ground, you really don't know. They might have initiated the demonstrations, but it seems as though they're very widespread with tens of thousands participating. So we'll see how all of this plays out, Dr. Horn. What we're going to do now is to move on to the conflict happening in Libya. And of course, on March 19th, 2011, the U.S.-backed NATO coalition began a military invasion in Libya, where they deposed Muammar Gaddafi's government in the most brutal way. And the country has been a mess, frankly, since then. And we'll talk a little bit, too, about what that overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya has meant, not only in for Libya itself, but for the region. But let us go to a short clip from Al Jazeera on the situation in Libya.
As Libya's conflict escalates, a dangerous double game is emerging. Western and regional powers are backing rival sides, even as they publicly call for calm. Will they ever cooperate and help stop the violence? It's been 8 years since the fall of Libya's leader Muammar Gaddafi, and the nation is once again at risk of an all-out war. Rival forces are intensifying their fight to control Tripoli. Troops loyal to the UN-backed government in the capital are trying to stop the advance of the warlord Khalifa Haftar. Libya has had two rival governments over the last few years. The UN-recognized administration led by Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj is based in the capital, Tripoli. Most Western nations support the unity government, including Italy, which is worried that the fighting will force more migrants to cross the Mediterranean. Qatar and Turkey also back Sarraj. In the east, there is the Tobruk-based government, the center of power for Khalifa Haftar. He is backed by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. France is also accused of providing military support to Haftar, and Russia recently vetoed a UN Security Council statement to condemn his advance on Tripoli. Now, protesters in Tripoli have urged the foreign ministry to summon the ambassadors of Egypt, the UAE, Saudi Arabia and France, and they say they want Libya's representatives to the UN, Arab League and the African Union to take measures against Haftar.
So there you go, Dr. Horn. So your take on what is happening here? I mean, since the fall of Muammar Gaddafi, the U.S. press, mainstream press, they've been so focused on what happened in Benghazi in 2012 and the so-named Clinton connection, which was used against her in her bid to become president of the United States. And of course, that was a incident in Benghazi where the U.S. Ambassador Chris Stephen was killed along with other U.S. Foreign Service representatives. But there's been a lot more going on in Libya. Tell us about how you see what's happening in Libya now, and also the role that the fall of the U.S.-backed fall of Muammar Gaddafi has meant for the entire region. Dr. Horn.
Well, the fall of Gaddafi obviously was catastrophic for the people of Libya in the first place, but also it's reverberated, I'm afraid to say, not only southward into sub-Saharan Africa, but northward across the Mediterranean into Italy itself. What I mean is that with the collapse of government and civil authority in Tripoli, Libya has become a gateway for African refugees seeking to cross the choppy waters of the Mediterranean to find refuge and sanctuary in Italy in particular. But the problem there has been that, number one, many of them have drowned in the Mediterranean, and number two, their presence in Italy itself has initiated a kind of counter-reaction by dint of manipulation by demagogic politicians who point to their presence in order to generate racism, which has led to a kind of unique neo-fascism erupting in Rome, in the center of government in Italy. It's also interesting to note that General Haftar, who was the main focus of the brief interlude that you played just a moment or so ago, is backed by a broad array of forces. Just before launching his attack on Tripoli, he had met with the leadership in Saudi Arabia. He's backed by Egypt, as your interlude suggested. He is also receiving support from the United Arab Emirates. He's receiving a kind of support from Russia and from France as well. He also is a partial U.S. citizen. Recall that he had come to power with Muammar al-Gaddafi in 1969, but broke with him and spent a good deal of his exile living in Virginia. The central government in Tripoli is not very popular, not least because it's seen as being beholden to religious zealots and to gangsters who maraud and loot the population. Sadly enough, I'm afraid to say that a kind of slavery has erupted in Libya as well, with darker-skinned people, particularly these African refugees that I was just making reference to, being sold on the open market. Is rather ironic, if not paradoxical, that the first black president, Barack Obama, helped to engineer an overthrow of Gaddafi that led to the rise of slavery in Libya. ironic, of course, because Mr. Obama was backed by many descendants of enslaved Africans himself. In any case, oil is never far from the picture when one talks about Libya, as the United States tries to force Venezuelan and Iranian oil off the market. This makes Libyan oil all the more important. I should also say it makes Russian oil all the more important as well, and Russia might be a prime beneficiary of this entire episode, this tragedy we see unfolding in North Africa.
Yeah, and indeed, the oil reserves in Libya, as you say, are really vital. They are the largest on the continent of Africa, it is being reported, and among the 10 largest globally, with about 46.4 billion barrels as of 2010. And just this morning, I was reading an article that the price of oil per barrel has gone up over worries about the destabilization of the uprising going on in Libya, as well as the curtailing by U.S. sanctions of oil coming from Venezuela. So we'll have to see how all of that plays out. And indeed, you're right to point out that that NATO-U.S. invasion that overthrew Muammar Gaddafi installed a religious fundamentalist government that was aligned with Saudi Arabia, it is reported. And it's also reported that it oversaw the mass enslavement of Black Libyans and sympathizers of Muammar Gaddafi. And just yesterday, the UN-backed government in Tripoli told Sky News that there could be an influx of more than 800,000 migrants from Libya to Europe if the instability continues. So a way of putting some pressure on there. We could spend more time on this, but let us move on then to another hotspot that's happening. And in relation to protesters who have been out on the streets and demanding yet another president step down, and that's in Algeria. So tell us about the situation here in Algeria, Dr. Horn.
Well, as you know, long-term President Bouteflika has just been forced out of office. He had been in power for about 20 years. He's in his early 80s. Yet he has not spoken in public for about 6 years. He is in a wheelchair and is seemingly barely holding on to life. What happened is that the military and those described colloquially as, quote, the power, unquote, forced him to step down and forced in a replacement. It's unclear whether or not that'll satisfy the protesters. Keep in mind that Algeria was subject to a bitter war of national liberation before the Liberation Front came to power in 1962. France was the colonizing power, but France saw Algeria the way the United States sees Hawaii, that is to say, as part of France itself. And in fact, there was a very substantial French-born population in Algeria who leaned to the right. They basically tried to ignite a settlers' revolt, not unlike the settlers' revolt, by the way, that led to the formation of the United States of America in 1776. But it was crushed, ultimately, and it was very bloody. In fact, you can see this in part in the film The Battle of Algiers, which the Black Panther Party used to use for political education. Speaking of the Black Panther Party, it's important to point out that during the 1960s and 1970s, Algeria was one of the closest allies of the Black Panther Party. Recall that there was a legation there, led for a while by Kathleen Cleaver and Eldridge Cleaver. Field Marshal Donald Cox, who was also in Algeria, has just published a memoir published by Haiti Books in Berkeley that details his stay in Algeria. And so I think it's important to say that just like Libya was very important to the Black Liberation Movement in the United States of America, not least because Gaddafi reaching out in terms of solidarity and also in terms of funding to certain Black nationalist groups, Algeria has also been important in that very same way. Also like Libya, Algeria is a major hydrocarbon power, not only a producer of oil, but of natural gas as well. And that suggests that Washington is keeping a very close and careful eye on the tumultuous events that are unfolding as we speak in Algeria.
Yeah. Excuse me. It seems, Dr. Horn, that the youth across in Sudan as well as Algeria are definitely flexing their muscles and making their voices heard, sending a message to the previous generation. And also, one has to wonder how much has been learned by the protesters in those countries with what happened in Egypt. We were all so excited about the Arab Spring in Egypt, and look at how that has ended up. So, Dr. Horn, thank you so very much for joining us and breaking this down for us. We want to do a lot more on the continent of Africa, where most, in a way, of the world's wealth beneath the ground lay. And I should also mention that Libya, in addition to being very, very rich in oil, they have some really large reserves of water, which a lot of people don't know about. And of course, we know that the battle for water is going to be key in the international fight over resources. So, Dr. Gerald Horn, thank you for joining us. We hope to hear from you on our weekly roundtable on Friday, and hope to be seeing you in Southern California in July. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, we are going to take a station break, and coming up, what's going on with the collaboration between left networks and organizations in the United States and Europe? We'll be hearing from Alan Minsky, and then we return to what's happening to migrants at the border. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And the living is easy. Fish are jumping. And cotton is high. Your dad is rich, and your ma is good looking.
All righty, and that is Summertime by the late, great Sam Cooke. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're also on Facebook. If you're a member, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And you could check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And our handle on Twitter and Instagram is at SoTrueRadio. We're also on SoundCloud, where all of our back shows, by the way, are archived, and you could find them by topic. And in our tradition, we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners. Let's see, in the United States, how about Cypress, California? Cypress, California, a shout out to you. And internationally, a shout out to our listeners in France. Of course, many there feeling the shock of the burning of the famed Notre Dame Cathedral that so much represented old Europe and what old Europe stood for. So it is on that note that we're going to now move on to our discussion about what is happening with political movements in the United States and Europe, in particular, left-leaning movements in the United States, and kind of forming and coming together more with similar like-minded movements in Europe. But we have to recall that this is within the context of the worry about the rising of Trump-like right-wing racist governments in Europe, and even in the Netherlands, where there were regional elections that happened recently, the right-wing, anti-immigrant right-wing, made some gains. We have seen that happening in Europe. Many, though, are heartened by what happened in Finland, where although the right wing did increase the percentage of the votes, nevertheless, they were not able to take control of the government. And now in Spain, elections are coming up, and the socialists in Spain, socialism, such a nasty word in the United States, not so in Europe, and the socialists are really hoping, and opinion polls are signaling that the Socialist Party could win a large share of the vote in a snap election that's going to be taking place on April 28th. But here to discuss a lot of this with us, let's welcome back to Sojourner Truth, Alan Minsky, Kaminsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. He's a lifelong activist as a progressive journalist for the past two decades. He most recently was the program director at KPFK, the Pacifica station in Los Angeles from 2009 to 2018, where he regularly coordinated Pacifica Radio's national political coverage. And before that, he was a founder, one of the founders of LA Indie Media. He's worked with Nation Magazine, Jacobin, and others. Alan Minsky, welcome back.
Great to be here, Margaret. Fantastic segment with Gerald Horn, and a perfect lead into our discussion now.
Right. So tell us what's going on. What are you up to? Because you are going to be on the way and participating to an interesting event coming up in Europe. What is all of that about?
Well, I actually went. I went to, and I ended up speaking in a chamber of the European Parliament, and I ended up also speaking at the headquarters in Brussels, Belgium, of what's called the Party of the European Left. And there is a formation in the European Parliament, which has 750 members, of groups that are to the left of the traditional social democratic or even labor parties in Europe. So the parties that maybe have their roots in Eurocommunism or have come out of the left wing of the environmental movement, or in the case of, for instance, the formation Podemos, or even new left formations, largely democratic socialist, have a capitalist critique, these parties, the new parties, and they position themselves again to the left of the socialist parties, which oftentimes in Western Europe, like the American Democratic Party and the UK Labour Party under Tony Blair, became advocates for basically neoliberalism, for, you know, the market can take care of the problems. And so that was the formation that we met with. And who were we? Well, I was part of a contingent that included the political director of the organization Our Revolution, the national director of Democratic Socialists of America, and the head of Justice Democrats being the campaign operation that was involved in organizing the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So it was a great meeting. It was very constructive. And it was a lot about forming bonds, in this case, of course, specifically across the Atlantic, between an ascendant American left and a European far left that itself is making, you know, small gains, nothing, unfortunately, like the far right. But, of course, the group that's really in decline, and this, of course, has an analog in the United States, are the so-called center-left parties, the parties like the German Social Democrats, the French Socialists, and, of course, in the UK, the center-leftists lost control of the party to Jeremy Corbyn and the left. So we met with this group, and while the general mood in Europe was one of real dismay because of the rise of the far right, it was not this particular formation that is in decline. And so they had a lot to look to because, of course, like us on the left in America, looking out at Trumpism, and then our comrades in Europe looking out at the rise of the far right, know that those formations will do nothing to improve the lives of the average working person, the decline of the middle class. In fact, they really amount to nothing more than a reentrenchment of the neoliberal order. You see that with Trump, with the tax cuts, with the radical deregulation that nobody has pursued as aggressively as the Trump administration has. Those are, of course, core components of neoliberalism. So a lot of the meetings were infused with a sense that, okay, we're now in a position with Bernie Sanders in America, Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, and potentially some of the parties we were meeting with in Europe, and this is true in some of the smaller countries, including Finland, bigger country like Spain, Slovenia, a few of the other countries where the far left enters into government in their parliamentary system. And because the center-leftists now rely in the fragments of these parliamentary coalitions on the far left, the far left ends up with a lot of influence in those countries.
Right. And I just saw an article about the far left being on the rise in Norway as well, that their Red Party, as it's called, polled at 7.6, which doesn't seem like a whole heck of a lot, but it's the highest ever. And we also saw in the United States in Chicago, you had some electoral right. victories for candidates from Democratic Socialists. So, but Alan Minsky, I wondered if there was any discussion or looking back in hindsight, I remember when so many of us were encouraged by the protests that were happening in Greece, right? And the what looked like a left party at the time turned out it was more center left party. And that was a party that Varoufakis, is that his name, resigned from. He was a finance man. And also of Podemos in Spain, a lot of us were really looking for Podemos to have much more of an impact. And I'm wondering if there is any assessment in terms of what, or if there wasn't there, your thoughts on what happened in terms of the, you know, Greece and Spain and those particular formations. And if some of that, you know, when we look at what's happening in Italy and the far right rise in Italy and the racist rise in Italy. But nevertheless, as you're saying, people are pressing forward and continuing to build and support those left formations. Any thoughts on any of this?
Well, it's very complicated, and especially complicated to audiences that aren't familiar with the way that the European Union is structured. And, of course, there's a lot of unhappiness with the structure of the European Union, and Greece was an object lesson in this. It's very difficult, proved to be very difficult for a small country like Greece to have its population vote for an agenda and then see that agenda get put into place, because it basically is, if you remember the episode, was vetoed by the Germans, the largest economy and most powerful country in the European Union, and by the people in Brussels at the time. And so it's a little complicated, but what's happening, I think, and this is, of course, a question internally for Syriza and Greece, which is probably a more difficult example because they actually are in government, and Podemos in Spain, who have a coordinated relationship with the larger socialist party, which they're, which might be moving slightly to the left under the influence of the presence of Podemos and other left forces. But basically, what has to happen, and I think people are aware of this, is to keep their eyes on what needs to happen, which is to break the neoliberal model. So, and for them to continue to be the sole true advocates for a return to strengthening European democratic socialists, even European social democracy. There's been, as you see in France, a complete collapse of the Socialist Party after Hollande came into government campaigning a few years back, about 6 years back, that he was going to strengthen the left hand of the state, the social democratic social contract, and he completely betrayed that. And so the party collapses. That leaves formations on the left in France and in other countries. You know, they can present themselves honestly to their electorate as the sole force that is really advocating for what people want. And much like in the United States, in poll after poll in Europe, what people want, just like, again, in the United States, you see with Bernie Sanders, the positions that he advocates for are supported very strongly by the majority of the people. And again, European politics are complex. You have situations where the far-right parties, in their racist approach to their societies, actually will campaign claiming that they will strengthen, again, the social democratic social contract, albeit only for Caucasian Europeans, and then, as you see in Italy, it's a betrayal even of that, because they form a compact with the business class and do not pursue those policies. Marie Le Pen ran on that. It's a question whether she'll run on it next time around again.
Yeah, and that's in France, of course.
Right. Yes, and again, one thing I, of course, would love to mention is it was not lost on this conference that we had to create bonds of international solidarity beyond Western Europe and the United States. And I think for the group that met, this is also a primary necessity going forward. We will remain in coordination. There'll be further contacts, and we're going to work out ways that we can strengthen the relationship again between the Party of the European Left and the organizations. And by the way, Bernie Sanders' foreign policy advisor, Matt Duss, was invited and was expected to be a part of the contingent. And we're not quite sure what happened either. It was because the Yemen vote came up or because something like the U.S. Senate wouldn't approve his travel because he's officially employed by the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
That he was unable to attend. So the Sanders team is more than just loosely coordinated with this effort.
Right. Well, there's a lot more to discuss here. We'll need to have you back soon, Alan Minsky. You know, there is the whole issue of the youth and the environmental movement, that Sunshine Movement and others, and the impact that that's happening in Europe, and the impact of the Greens generally. But we're going to have to end it there. Alan Minsky, thank you so very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Margaret Prescott. Always great to be with you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host host of Sojourner Truth. Now, last year, people around the world fiercely condemned the Donald's administration for its inhumane handling of the Central American migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, which included separating children from their parents under a zero-tolerance policy, placing migrants in unlivable housing conditions, allowing migrant children to die under ICE or Immigration Authority custody, and shooting families attempting to cross the border with rubber bullets, among other atrocities. And then, of course, Trump's big deal national emergency. There was an attempt by the Democrats to stop this national emergency, declaring a national emergency at the border. But Trump, of course, vetoed what happened in Congress and got his national emergency, and is also threatening to increase the number of troops that are at the border. And now he is signaling that he wants to move forward with plans to bus undocumented migrants from Central America to so-named sanctuary cities and states. Let us go to a clip now from the Daily Mail on this.
Well, you know, the people that are putting sanctuary cities where they're not even wanted, because, as you know, in California and other places, a lot of communities want to get out of sanctuary cities. They don't want them, but they always seem to have open arms. So we thought, rather than moving the illegal immigrants to other parts of the country, first of all, we're getting them, and we're doing the best we can with very bad laws. We have to change the laws. But we're apprehending thousands and thousands of people a day. We'll bring them to sanctuary city areas and let that particular area take care of it, whether it's a state or whatever it might be. California certainly is always saying, oh, we want more people, and they want more people in their sanctuary cities. Well, we'll give them more people. We can give them a lot. We can give them an unlimited supply. And let's see if they're so happy. They say we have open arms. They're always saying they have open arms. Let's see if they have open arms.
Are you asking for more troops on the border as well?
And we're going to put more troops on the border. Yeah, we're going to. We are giving very strong consideration to having people after a 20-day period because, again, you're not allowed legally to hold them for more than that. We will move them into sanctuary cities. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
All righty. So there you hear the Donald, his latest swipes there, and he's preparing for 2020, where clearly he wants to use the issue of migrants and immigrants as a wedge issue. But meanwhile, the Trump administration, again, is trying to challenge the Flores Agreement, which has to do with the 20-day rule that migrant children, whether they arrive with family or are unaccompanied, cannot be held in detention for more than 20 days. So the White House is preparing to challenge that rule again. And on the line with us, we have Peter Shea, who is the lead attorney for the team that oversees the court order and inspects facilities for migrant children. And he is the executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. Peter Shea, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
So, Peter Shea, before we get into this whole business of Trump's latest moves, we do want to find out, though, how are the children doing, the children who've been separated from their families at the border, and also the families who are remaining in detention? Peter Shea.
Well, there are likely several thousand children who have still not been reunited with their families. The problem was that when the separation policy was instituted, there was absolutely no strategic planning conducted regarding how those children would ever be reunited with their parents. The government did not keep track of where they were sending the parents and where they were sending the children. So the result is that there are likely still several thousand children who have not been reunited with their families. Reunification could indeed be extremely difficult because under coercive tactics, threats, and whatnot, most of those parents were summarily deported after being coerced into pleading guilty to misdemeanor entry into the United States. By the way, we think most of those guilty pleas were illegally obtained, because if somebody enters the United States with a reasonable fear of persecution and with the intention to present themselves to a Border Patrol official and to seek political asylum, we don't believe that that was an illegal entry under federal law. And secondly, most of those parents pled guilty because they knew and they were told that that was the only way they could begin efforts to locate their children and reunite with their children. Having said that, a large number of children remain in federal custody at this time. Some of those children are in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which handles all unaccompanied minors. And once these children were separated from their parents, they were defined as unaccompanied minors. So they went into the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, where many still are in custody. And some have been placed in long-term foster care. So at this time, the administration has said that it would take about another 2 years just to identify who these children are and to attempt to make efforts at reunification. So that's where that situation stands at this time.
Yeah, and that's worrying on so many different fronts. We know, for example, in the child welfare system, foster care and adoption, which over the years have taken so many children from their families here in the United States, Black, Brown, Native American children, poor white children, simply because the families are poor. But also under a law passed under the Clinton administration, children who are detained under that system that are 3 years and younger, they go under fast track adoption. And so it is very worrying about this 2 year time period that you just mentioned, because there could be the worry that some parents may actually lose parental rights for their children. But tell us, too, though, about these moves by the Trump administration. Now they're saying, oh, there's so many coming in, we can't possibly process everybody. So there's a whole catch and release. And then why don't we just funnel and send all of these migrants and immigrants, undocumented immigrants, to sanctuary cities? So it seems as though Trump, he is making some political calculations, never mind the rights and the well-being and justice of the families and children who are being impacted here. Your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, it definitely seems as if the chaos at the border is largely manufactured by the Trump administration for political purposes, gearing up for the 2020 election. As part of his national declaration of an emergency at the border, President Trump and his top officials and surrogates have repeatedly told the public that the situation is out of control at the border, that the Border Patrol is being overrun by these migrant families, and that they don't have bed space, and therefore they are forced, against their will, they are forced to engage in what they repeatedly call a catch and release policy, and telling the public that these are many drug dealers and criminals, and that they're somehow just forced to release them promptly upon apprehension, or promptly when they present themselves to apply for asylum, because of the chaos and because of the large numbers and because of the lack of the bed space. Our recent investigation into these matters has determined that that situation is completely manufactured by the Trump administration. And what we have discovered recently, just in the past few weeks, is that indeed the two major family detention centers that were originally set up by President Obama in 2015 and that have a capacity to hold about 3,000 parents with children, and that are contracted for hundreds of millions of dollars with private contractors, what we have discovered is, in fact, that those are about 90% empty. that in the past, ever since Trump initiated his national emergency narrative, that they have actually emptied out those two family detention centers. One is in Dilley, Texas, which could hold about 2,000 children with their parents, and is down to 300 children and parents. And the other is at Karnes, which could hold about 1,000 parents and children, and currently has no parents and children. So on the one hand, while the Trump administration has repeatedly stated publicly as part of its national border emergency narrative that they're being overrun, that they have no bed space, they're forced to catch and release, on the other hand, that seems to be completely contrived, because they have actually emptied out the family detention centers. And at this point, even though they have capacity of about 3,000, they only have about 300 families in detention.
Right. So maybe Trump will planning on or hoping that these immigrants will go to places like California, and really attempting, I think, to undermine support for the movement in support of immigrant, undocumented immigrants in particular, as well as asylum seekers. And increasingly, we see the likes of Stephen Miller, who, as far as I'm concerned, is an extreme racist, now having so much sway in the White House, and a lot of his ideas that he's espoused for years, now Donald Trump picking up to make policy. Peter Shea, we'll have you back soon. There's so much to discuss here in terms of the threat to the Flores Agreement, but also all of the billion-dollar industry behind the separation of children, where to even tech giant Microsoft is involved with a $19.4 million contract for ICE and other corporate entities. So a lot of money is also being made off of these migrants. And meanwhile, another caravan is on its way. So we'll see how all of that goes. But we appreciate you, Peter, and the work of your group there. And we hope to speak with you soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Happy to be back. Thank
okay. You. We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our audio engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacific Array Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you so much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We'll go out with Aretha Franklin.